Thanks for inviting me to speak at the quantum gravity seminar. Of course, this talk will be entirely classical, so just imagine everything is in an expectation value, and I'm ignoring order H bar corrections. All right. So I'll give a bit of a historical introduction, because this is a problem I've been working on. I did it for my PhD thesis, and for some reason, which I'll explain, we're still dealing with it. So the issue is that in cosmology, the universe is homogeneous and isotropic at large scales. So we approximate everything by a Robertson-Walker background spacetime. And on top of this, at large scales, we have linear perturbations. However, at small scales, density fluctuations can be extremely large. You have stars and galaxies, and nonlinear dynamics are important, so the linear approximation won't work because you have bound systems. But it's at these small scales where the Einstein equation holds. So the issue is you have to average your small scale behavior to get to your Robertson-Walker background. But because of these nonlinear terms, computing of the Einstein tensor of a metric and averaging do not commute. So the Einstein tensor of the averaged metric is not in general equal to the average of the Einstein tensor of the exact metric where the Einstein equation holds. So when you go from these small scales to the large scales, you're neglecting something, which is indicated by this inequality here. So this issue was first raised by George Ellis in the 80s, and he called it the fitting problem in cosmology, which is, you know, how do we fit a homogeneous and isotropic background spacetime to an inhomogeneous actual universe. So he imagined that you have like some really inhomogeneous spacetime, and you devise some sort of procedure to progressively smooth it out on larger and larger scales until you get to your Robertson-Walker background. So as the end result of this is that your background metric satisfies the Einstein equation, but with some sort of new effective stress energy term that comes from the average of these small scale nonlinear terms. And this is what we've referred to as back reaction. So Lee, do you give a?
Yeah, I think it goes back further than that. I think Rich Isaacson
in Oh yeah, Isaacson worked definitely on the shortwave approximation like for gravitational radiation, yeah. That, I mean, I don't think the application was cosmology back then. It was more they were trying to construct geons and stuff like that.
I think it was
maybe both. Okay, it might go back to Isaacson then. That's possible. Anyway, but this idea really got revived after people discovered cosmic acceleration. So what if, you know, you could put two and two together? So you get this TAB zero. What if it took the form of a cosmological constant? And then maybe this effective cosmological constant could explain away dark energy. So this led to a whole flurry of papers. For example, this cosmological parameters are dressed, the idea that you have to apply some correction to get the actual parameter from what you measure, or can a global far from equilibrium state explain dark energy or accelerated expansion from structure formation? And most of these papers were kind of led by this by Thomas Bucherte and also George Ellis and a few other people. And sorry, yeah.
How they obtain the negative pressure is perturbation.
What's that?
Negative pressure of cosmic response.
Yeah, they were hoping to get a negative pressure term. Yeah, they're guessing so far. I mean, I've not explained yet how they make these claims. But most of the stuff follow this framework that Bucherte devised on how to average a spacetime, and Bob Wald and Akihiro Ishibashi looked at this, and they came to they asked the question, can the acceleration of our universe be explained by the effect of inhomogeneities? Abstract, no. It is simply not plausible. And they pointed out some flaws with the Bucherte formalism, and they did some order of magnitude estimates, and they concluded you couldn't have any sort of effects like that. But then I came along for my PhD, And with Bob Wald, I came up with this new framework for analyzing the effects of small scale inhomogeneities, which is much more general and does, you know, it's much more complete than this analysis of Ishibashi and Wald. And then a couple, after, you know, there were more papers along these lines, we wrote a review paper, How Well Is Our Universe Described by a Robertson-Walker Model? Abstract extremely well. And basically, we argued that what people normally do in cosmology is just fine. But then, just last year, Buchert teamed up with 10 of his friends and wrote a paper, Is There Proof That Back Reaction of Inhomogeneities Is Irrelevant in Cosmology? Abstract, no. And then he says, it's incorrect to infer that Green and Wald have proven a general result that addresses the essential physical questions of back reaction. So then we wrote a short response to this one. And then we realized that one of the main problems, I think, with the understanding is that this framework that we came up with is fairly, you know, it's fairly complicated. It involves one parameter families of perturbations, and it's fairly mathematical. And that might have been an obstacle for our ideas getting across. So we came up with this more simple heuristic derivation of our no back reaction results. And that's what I'm planning to present today, along with making contact with the earlier work. So the outline, well, I'm going to have a little bit more motivation to explain why this is an interesting problem. And then I'll give you that heuristic derivation of our results. And then I'll connect it to that rigorous framework. And then I will compare it to the Buchert formalism and what they do and why I think that's not valid. And then finally, I'll go a little bit further and talk about cosmological perturbation theory within this framework. So there are a couple observations. First one is that while the density and homogeneities are very large at small scales, metric inhomogeneities are small except near strong field objects. So this picture that Ellis had, where you're trying to take some average of some really complicated distribution or fitting problem for the matter, is really more like you're trying to fit the surface of, or the metric, or the surface of a ball bearing with a few imperfections to a perfect sphere. It looks a lot simpler to do. So this is a good analogy to what we have in our universe, if you imagine a lot more faces on this, because the metric here, measuring distances, is extremely close to the metric here. But now imagine all these edges and vertices are smoothed out just a tiny bit. If you look at a vertex, it can have a huge amount of curvature, even though the metric is nearly flat. And that's because the metric is changing over short distance scales. So through the Einstein equation, that curvature is then related to the stress energy. So you get fluctuations in your stress energy that can be quite large, even though the fluctuations in your metric are small. And if you look at, say, first derivatives instead of second derivatives, that would be what's relevant for, say, geodesic motion along one of these surfaces. And, you know, you can get some, you know, deviations from flat space geodesics if you have this kind of, you know, bumpy surface. And that would be reflected in cosmology because you can measure lensing type effects. So to keep in mind for your intuition is just the Poisson equation, because where phi, that's a metric component, if we take two derivatives of phi, and phi varies over short distance scales, we can have large curvature fluctuations or matter fluctuations. OK, well, that's the first observation. The second observation is even when that's true and you have small metric perturbations, you can get significant back reaction if the derivatives are large. So a good example where you do get significant back reaction is a vacuum universe filled with gravitational radiation. So here I'm writing the full metric GAB. That's a solution. Assume it's a solution to the vacuum Einstein equation. And assume we can write it as a metric with Robertson-Walker symmetry, but we don't necessarily assume the Friedman equation. And plus a perturbation gamma, which is small. But that perturbation gamma will represent gravitational waves. So schematically, it takes the form of some small amplitude times a sine of x over L, where L is some short wavelength associated with the gravitational wave. Now let's plug this into the Einstein equation and expand out the Einstein tensor. So we have 0 is equal to GAB of the full metric, and we expand that as the Einstein tensor of the background metric, which is, we'll say, of order 1 over r squared, where r is the curvature scale of the background, plus a linearized Einstein tensor of gamma, and that would be of order a over l squared, because there are two derivatives appearing in the Einstein tensor, and one factor of the metric perturbation here, plus a second order contribution that goes as a squared over l squared, plus a higher order. Now, if we assume now that a times r over l is of order 1, in other words, we have short wavelength perturbations, then the leading term is the linearized Einstein tensor. So if we set this to 0, that gives us an equation for the gravitational waves. But then at next order, we have both of these terms. They're both the same order. So what is consistent to do is to take both of these two terms and equate them to 0 and take an average. So then we have that the Einstein tensor of the background metric plus the average of the second order Einstein tensor has to be equal to 0. So this average of the second order Einstein tensor, that is your effective back reaction stress energy tensor. And with a bunch of work, this is stuff that Richard Isaacson, as Lee pointed out, worked on. He saw that, you know, you would get a P equals a third row equation of state, which is exactly what you would expect for radiation fluid in cosmology. So back reaction isn't so mysterious after all in that case. Okay, so ordinary perturbation theory is not capable of treating the scenario where you have small metric perturbations, but large density perturbations and small scale nonlinear dynamics and, of course, potential back reaction. But that shortwave approximation that I just talked about on the last slide is capable of describing back reaction due to tensor modes or gravitational waves. So the question is, what about back reaction due to scalar and vector modes, which are sourced by matter inhomogeneities? What form would this take? And that's the interest we have. So the goal is to develop an improved perturbative framework that allows for, you know, by estimating sizes, an a priori large amount of back reaction due to matter inhomogeneities, and then use it to constrain any such effects. And the main result that we prove within this setup is that if the matter stress energy tensor satisfies the weak energy condition, in other words, if matter has positive energy density according to every time-like observer, then the effective stress energy of back reaction must be traceless, and it has to satisfy the weak energy condition itself. So in particular, it just corresponds to gravitational radiation, and there's no new contribution from the scalar and vector modes. So in particular, you can't mimic a cosmological constant. OK, now I'm going to give the heuristic derivation of our results. So first, we have to make a whole bunch of assumptions. So first, we'll assume that the space-time metric solves this GAB. That solves the Einstein equation on all scales, and it takes the form of a background metric plus a perturbation. So we'll take the background curvature to be order 1 over r squared. But we're not going to assume any form for the GAB of 0. So, but in cosmology, you might take it to have FLRW symmetry. But we won't assume anything. And then the gamma, the perturbation, we assume it has small amplitude. And in cosmology, it would be of order 10 to the minus 4, maybe. But we're going to allow gamma to have large derivatives. And we're only going to constrain them by saying that the derivative of gamma times gamma in some Euclidean norm is much less than 1 over r. So gamma, the derivative of gamma itself isn't constrained. It's just that when it's multiplied by gamma, it's small. We also don't constrain second derivatives at all, so potentially second derivatives of gamma could be much larger than 1 over r squared. So because of the Einstein equation, you can have large stress energy perturbations because the stress energy is related to the curvature, which has two derivatives. Okay, we also assume that the matter stress energy satisfies the weak energy condition. So TAB, TATB is greater than or equal to 0 for all time-like TAs. And we also assume that TAB is essentially homogeneous beyond some scale L. So this, in our universe, we would take L to be maybe 100 megaparsecs, and R would be like 3 gigaparsecs. So what we mean by this is that we can write TAB as TAB0, some background part, which is of order 1 over R squared, plus some deviation, delta TAB, that averages to 0 on scales compared to L. So averaging, here's one issue, though, is that averaging of tensors is generally not possible in a curved spacetime. And that's because you would want to parallel propagate your tensor around to some point, but that's path dependent, so you can't really define a good average. But the metric, the background metric, is locally flat in a region much smaller than R, namely anything bigger than L, much smaller than R, it's locally flat. So averaging is well defined on these small scales. So what we mean then by the fact that this delta T averages to zero is if we take some slowly varying test tensor field, so a tensor field that has compact support and is smooth and it varies slowly, and it has support over some region larger than L, then F times delta TAB, the integral of that, is much less than F times the background stress energy tensor. And that's what we mean by this term is negligible under averages. Okay, so those are our assumptions. So there's basically three steps in this proof. The first is that you average the Einstein equation under these assumptions. So the Einstein equation written out. And to do that, let's rewrite it as where we'll expand out the GAB, the Einstein tensor. So we write, we'll move all of the background quantities to the left-hand side. So on the right-hand side, we have the linearized Einstein tensor, the second order, third order, and so on, this expansion in gamma. And we've also split the stress energy into the background plus the oscillating part.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Put any condition for trace should be traced. It should have trace because Kazman Sonson has it. Which field you start with?
Yeah.
Which perturbation you use to have trace?
What term should have a trace?
Kazman constant.
Yeah, this term has a non-zero trace. Sure. We're interested in the question of is this stuff equal to zero or not? Right? If this is not equal to zero, then whatever it's equal to, in fact, we'll define to be the effective stress energy tensor. And the question is, does this quantity have trace? So we don't worry so much about this. Yeah, I'm just putting this in to be general. But the question is, does this term have it? So what we're going to do is take the average of this Einstein equation. The left-hand side is unchanged under averaging because everything's just a background quantity. But the right-hand side, we're just going to define whatever its average is to be the effective stress energy tensor. And now I'm going to go term by term on the right-hand side and consider each one. So I have my five terms here. Well, these first two terms, those just vanish because it's homogeneous beyond size L, right? This term is very small compared to the actual stress energy tensor, which was on the left-hand side. This is small compared to the background metric. The third order term is very small compared to the second order term because the Einstein tensor has only two derivatives, and this has another factor of the metric, which makes it small. So the only terms we need to worry about are G1 and G2. Well, let's estimate G1, its average. Well, we can just approximate this because the dominant terms in the linearized Einstein tensor are going to be of the form d d gamma, according to our counting scheme. So we can write that the magnitude of f integrated with GAB1, what we do is we integrate by parts and we pull these derivatives onto the f. You can do that because f has compact support. And then You can replace gamma, its norm, by the maximum of gamma, pull it outside the integral, and you can replace the derivatives of f by 1 over r squared. And then, well, this maximum is of gamma is very small, so this term is negligible. So we don't have to worry about the g1 term essentially by integration by parts and the fact that metric perturbation is small. So to our level of approximation, we only have to worry about the GAB2. So the effective stress energy tensor is the average of minus 1 over 8 pi GAB2. Well, we can rewrite that a little bit. What are the terms that appear in GAB2? We have d gamma type terms, and we have gamma dd gamma type terms. But these ones can all be rewritten in terms of the first type. So you can rewrite the whole thing if you want in terms of d gamma type terms. So at this stage, we've averaged the Einstein tensor subject to our assumption of sizes of various terms. But the average of the Einstein equation contains much less information than the full Einstein equation, which holds at each spacetime point. And this means that we have a whole bunch of ignorance, in fact, which is encapsulated in the fact that this TAB0 is completely unconstrained, except to say that it's expressed as an average of quadratic products of d gamma. And we need to do a lot better than this to get our, you know, tracelessness condition. So what we're going to do is we're going to use the fact that the Einstein equation holds at each point in order to further constrain TAB0. So step two, we've already averaged the Einstein equation. Now we want to prove the tracelessness of the effective stress energy. And to do that, we need control of the gamma, the metric perturbation. So we'd like to impose that the linearized Einstein equation holds for gamma. But we can't quite do that because that would constitute a new unjustified assumption. In particular, it would rule out nonlinear motion at small scales. So that's not quite valid. But we have kind of a trick to do it, which is we'll take the full Einstein equation and multiply it by your metric perturbation. So in that case, and then we'll take the average. In that case, the only terms that matter in the end are that remain in the equation are the average of gamma times the first order Einstein tensor and gamma times the stress energy perturbation, because both of these terms are a priori like order background level. Now this is where the weak energy condition comes in, and it's going to show that the right hand side is negligible. So we choose. We can choose anything for our test function or test tensor field, and we're going to choose it to be FCD times TATB, so the time-like vector, which we choose. In that case, the right-hand side turns into, the two time-like vectors dot into delta T turns into the perturbation of rho. So now we have this right-hand side is the test function times gamma times delta rho. But this part is completely negligible. The contribution from the background rho is negligible because gamma is very small.
Yes. F is that one that varies slowly still?
Yeah, F is varying slowly, yes. And this is some time-like vector field. So yeah, this whole notation that I'm using, this just corresponds to how we do our averaging. So it's like some sort of window function I'm smearing everything with. But I'm choosing it very carefully so that I can pull out this density, which I know is going to be positive. That's the plan. So then I can try to estimate the size of the magnitude of that integral. So I put my absolute value signs around it. And then this step, I'm doing a lot of things. So one is I'm putting the magnitude or the absolute values inside the metric, inside the integral, around the integrand. And then I'm pulling out the gamma as before, which is small. But now this is where I use the fact that rho is positive. I can remove the absolute value signs from rho since it's positive. And then the integral of rho, it turns into just the same as the integral of the background density, right? Saying rho averages to its background value. And then as a result, I can approximate that by 1 over r squared. And then since the gamma, the metric perturbation, is small, this whole quantity is small. So that used the positivity of the energy density to get this. But now, this FCDAB can be any general FCDAB can be approximated by a linear combination of terms like I've used here, where I just pick different t's and I just add them up. So then, to our level of approximation, the integral FCDAB, gamma CD G1AB, is equal to 0. That was what the quantity on the previous slide, this is equal to 0. OK. Finally, you can integrate by parts. And it turns out that this, the trace of this term, gamma traced with G1 is equal to G2. Now, G2, the average of that, sorry, the trace of G2 is the trace of the effective stress energy tensor. So that vanishes. So what I've done is I've used the I've used the linearized Einstein equation and the fact that the matter has to have positive energy density to show the tracelessness of the effective stress energy tensor. Okay? Okay, now the final element of the proof is that I need to show that the effective stress energy also satisfies the weak energy condition. And this is more complicated. So what you do is you have your manifold M, and I'm going to choose some point P in that manifold and a unit time-like vector at P. Okay. And now I'm going to choose F to be some positive test function with support containing P like this. And I want to show that that TAB TATB is positive, right? It has positive average. So this is what I want to do. I want to show that, and that will be demonstrating the weak energy condition. And the trick I'm going to do now is construct Riemannian normal coordinates around this point P. So I write my metric is equal to a flat metric minus some higher order curvature terms. And the essential idea is now I can just approximate everything as being in flat space. OK, so the formula for the integral of FAB TAB 0 from before, this is equal to this average of this second order Einstein tensor. And what you can do is show that, in fact, this term can be written entirely in terms of spatial derivatives of spatial components of your metric perturbation. This is using some of the results on the last slide. Okay. That's important that it's only the spatial parts. And then I'm going to absorb the F into the metric perturbation, define a new variable psi. And then to our level of approximation, this is now equal to this. Just it's the same expression as before, but without the F appearing explicitly. And now this psi now has compact support. And it's in a flat space. And I'm going to pretend essentially that each of these components, these spatial coordinates, they extend from minus infinity to infinity, and I'll do a Fourier transform. So I kind of isolated this flat space region, doing my Fourier transform spatially. And then I can decompose into scalar, vector, and tensor parts. So my scalar parts are sigma and phi, and I have a vector part z and a tensor part sij. Then the whole thing reduces to this very nice expression. So we have one part of the expression is manifestly positive, and it's a tensor contribution from the S. And this corresponds directly to gravitational waves. And then I get another negative scalar part. And this is from the matter inhomogeneities. And I want to show that this vanishes to the order we're working. And then I would have proven positivity. So in position space, this scalar term can be rewritten as the gradient of phi squared. So it's just your Newtonian binding energy. And so we could suppose that phi is going to satisfy the Poisson equation, that you know Laplacian of phi is related to the density. The actual equation is much more complicated, but for this our purposes, I'm just going to use this. So then this gravitational binding energy can be rewritten by integrating by parts and using this equation as the integral of phi times f times rho. And then the magnitude of this has to be less than or equal to the integral of phi times rho, where again, now I'm using the positivity of rho, the assumption of the weak energy condition for the matter. And that is then now, and I also use that the amplitude of phi has to be very small. So this whole quantity is small by like the same arguments as before. So this scalar part contributes negligibly, and this TAB satisfies the weak energy condition. So this is actually a really essential part of the proof, this assumption of the actual space-time stress-energy tensor satisfying the weak energy condition, because we've been able to construct examples where we ignore that, and then we get tons of crazy back reaction that's unphysical. Okay, so but our results were actually proven in this rigorous framework of one-parameter families of metrics. So instead of saying, you know, to our level of approximation, we actually prove theorems. And then the question is, how close are we to the limiting case of this one-parameter family? Are we close enough such in our actual universe so that the theorems apply? So I'm going to try to make a connection between what I just said and this. So we imagine we have a manifold M and a derivative operator on that manifold. And suppose we have a one-parameter family of metrics, GAB of lambda, for lambda greater than or equal to 0, satisfying these properties. So for lambda greater than 0, but not equal to 0, we have the Einstein equation has to hold, where TAB of lambda is just defined as whatever the left-hand side is. And we require it to satisfy the weak energy condition. We have that the metric perturbation goes to 0 with lambda, or divided by lambda, is uniformly bounded as lambda goes to 0. This is the assumption the metric perturbation is small. We have that the derivative of a metric perturbation is bounded as lambda goes to 0. This is saying there's some control on our derivatives, but we're not saying that they're small. And we have the quadratic products of derivatives of metric perturbations have to converge weakly to some tensor field. So I'll explain this a bit later, but this is basically an assumption that averages exist. And then notice, though, that you know from these assumptions, in particular assumption one, we haven't said anything about GAB of 0 and what equation it has to satisfy. And what we can prove, or what we're going to derive from these assumptions, is an equation for GAB of 0 with an effective stress energy tensor. So it's a very kind of, yeah?
Is the derivative operator metric compatible on the
computer? No, it doesn't have, I mean, I think we would, probably we would take it to be the derivative operator associated with GAB of 0.
So
I mean, that's what we do in our proof.
Three.
What's that?
We need to rewrite 3.
We can rewrite 3, yeah, you're right. That this is just to be explicit. I agree. yeah, we'll typically take it to be this one, but we could have taken any derivative operator. Yeah, so from these assumptions, though, we're going to get some sort of singular limit where we get an effective stress energy tensor just kind of popping out for GAB of 0. OK, so to think about this one-parameter family a bit more, we have our space-time of interest. That's going to exist at some lambda naught. And then we're going to attach to that some collection of metrics as lambda goes to 0. And since the metric converges uniformly, but its first derivatives are only bounded, then the spatial scale of the perturbations has to decrease as lambda goes to 0. And of course, the second derivatives are, we don't say anything about that. So that can be unbounded as lambda goes to 0. So the stress energy is unbounded. So the picture we have in mind is this. So this is my representation of the universe, and these blobs might be galaxies or something. So as we decrease lambda, these the stress energy, or these galaxies, get smaller and they get closer together, but their density increases. And we take this limit where, you know, we keep taking all the way over here, and we get our final result in that case. So assumption four, this weak limit assumption. So the definition of a weak limit is closely related to our averages. So we say that a tensor field alpha of lambda converges to alpha zero weakly if and only if, for all compact support test fields, the integral of alpha of lambda minus alpha zero times that test field converges to zero, and the limit is lambda goes to zero. So this is our averaging assumption. And examples of weak convergence would be sine of x over lambda would go to zero, so, and sine squared of x over lambda would go to a half. So this is, so really taking the weak limit, it corresponds to averaging at small values of lambda. So this assumption assumes that this quantity has an average. Okay, so the proof essentially proceeds the same way as the heuristic derivation. So we take weak limits of the Einstein equation, and we get that the effective stress energy tensor is expressed in terms of these mu's, which, remember, are weak limits of quadratic products of gamma. So this is similar to the expression we had before, except it looks more complicated. And then you can also take the Einstein equation, multiply it by the metric perturbation, and take lambda goes to zero weakly, and you get some constraint on the mu's. And when you put all this together, you get our theorem, which is if GAB is a one of lambda is a one parameter family of metrics satisfying those assumptions, then the background metric has to be a solution of this effective Einstein equation, where you have this effective stress energy tensor, which is traceless and satisfies the weak energy condition itself. So this work, I mean, was really kind of an outcrop of this analysis of Greg Burnett, which was Bob Garosha's or Wald's student, who was trying to study this Isaacson averaging. And we just figured out how to put a stress energy tensor on the right-hand side of the equation and get the same results. So anyway, this is the precise theorem, and the results apply to our universe as long as we're sufficiently close to the limiting case, like as I was trying to get across in the heuristic derivation. So what do other people do? So this is what Buchert does. And this is the main alternative approach to averaging in the literature. They put the metric into a co-moving synchronous gauge. So they have a spatial metric, and it's co-moving with the matter. I mean, the time-like vector is. And they define now spatial averages instead of space-time averages of scalars. So if you have a scalar psi, you can compute its integral on some region D of this slice, and you call it the average of psi when you divide by the volume. And then they define an average scale factor, which is just the cube root of the volume of one of these regions. And then you can get equations for AD by just averaging the scalar parts of the Einstein equation. Now there's two scalar parts. There's a Hamiltonian constraint in the Rache-Hadoury equation that they average, and they get from that these modified Friedmann equations. So it just looks like a regular Friedmann equation for the AD, except now you have these new back reaction terms, these QDs on the right-hand side. And these terms are, I mean, they're quadratic in the expansion and the shear of your matter, and you also have this integrability constraint. So if you make Q sufficiently large, you can get some kind of acceleration. So this is basically where they end off, and they try to speculate how Q might behave. But there's a lot of issues with this approach. So the first one is, when the deviations of the metric from exact Robertson-Walker are not small, it's not clear how to interpret average quantities like AD. So in their paper, Ishibashi and Wald took, as an extreme example, they took two completely disconnected decelerating Robertson-Walker spacetimes, and they computed AD from those spacetimes, the joint AD, and saw that it was accelerating, which is obviously ludicrous to interpret as an accelerating spacetime if you have two completely disconnected decelerating spacetimes. Another problem is that they only average the scalar parts of the Einstein equation. There are a lot of other components of the Einstein equation out there. Another issue is they work in this co-moving synchronous gauge, where late-time perturbations to the metric are, in general, not going to be small. If you take the metric of the Earth and you put it into a co-moving synchronous gauge, you'll run into caustics within very short times. So this isn't even going to be valid at late times in the universe. And then finally, the Bucherd equations are only a partial set of equations. The evolution of this back reaction scalar is not determined by anything. So their general approach seems to be, we will make some guesses. Like, maybe it looks like a scalar field or whatever. And then they try to get some back reaction effect. There's one paper that they wrote where they claimed that you could average a vacuum spacetime and get an inflating spacetime out of that, which doesn't make any sense, since the average of any sort of vacuum perturbation is going to be a traceless stress energy tensor corresponding to gravitational waves. So we improve on all of these things we obtain an approximation to the true metric instead of some quantity that we don't know how to interpret, and then you could get a better approximation and compute all of your measurable quantities within your actual metric. Instead of averaging only the scalar parts, we average the full Einstein equation. We wouldn't use co-moving synchronous gauge. In fact, we would require your metric perturbation to be small, so you should work in a good gauge like longitudinal gauge at late times. And furthermore, we use much more of the Einstein equation. I tried to emphasize, we don't just average the Einstein equation. We try to use the small scale behavior as well in order to constrain the back reaction effects. So we get some constraints on our effective stress energy. We can go beyond the background level as well. So this is just going a bit further. Since in cosmology, you want to know the dynamics not only of the background metric, but of the deviations from the background. And at large scales, you expect these to behave linearly. So what would you do in ordinary perturbation theory? You would assume that your metric can be Taylor expanded in lambda, which is your perturbation parameter. And you could define your gamma then, just it's the derivative of your metric with respect to lambda evaluated at lambda equals 0. This is how you would formally do perturbation theory. And we can rewrite this very explicitly as a limit as lambda goes to 0 of g of lambda minus g of 0 over lambda. And similarly, for the equations of motion, you can differentiate the equations of motion with respect to lambda and evaluate at lambda equals 0, and that gives you your linearized equation. But this limit here, that doesn't exist in our framework based on our assumptions. This is only constrained to be bounded as lambda goes to 0. So instead of taking ordinary limits, we'll define our long wavelength part to be the weak limit of this quantity, which should average out the small scale in homogeneities. And I'm going to find that this gamma L, this long wavelength part, obeys an analogous equation to the linearized Einstein equation, but with new terms. And then all the remaining stuff in the metric perturbation, I'm going to call a short wavelength part. I'm not going to say much about that, except that it behaves nonlinearly at small scales and has to account for all of that motion. So then we can write the full metric as the background plus the linearized part plus the short wavelength part. Okay, so like I said, to get the linearized Einstein equation, you would ordinarily differentiate your Einstein equation with respect to lambda and set lambda equals 0. But now what we're going to do is take the weak limit of the equation at lambda minus the equation, the background equation, divide by lambda, take its weak limit as lambda goes to 0. And this is fairly complicated. You do get a lot of new terms. So we have to add one more assumption to our four assumptions, which is that a whole bunch of other averages exist. So we have averages of gamma, d gamma, gamma, d gamma, d gamma, divided by lambda. All of these are a priori non-averaging, and they need to exist. So we make these assumptions. And then this is the equation we get. And it's kind of a huge mess. But if you look closely, you do have, you know, standard linearized Einstein equation terms, and your average of your stress energy perturbation at long wavelengths. But you do have a few other terms, and you had to do something with them. Well, remember, we did some tricks before. We took the Einstein equation, we multiplied it by the metric perturbation, and we took weak limits. We can do analogous things at higher order also. I'm not going to get into the details, but you can derive some relations between these nonlinear terms. And they are kind of a mess. But then you can simplify the equation. And as you can see, there are a few fewer terms in this one. It's still complicated, and it's extremely general. But it does simplify for the case of cosmology with dust and Newtonian assumptions on the small scale motion, which I'll just give you the result for that. So we assume that the stress energy tensor takes the form of dust. We assume the background is spatially flat Robertson Walker, and there's negligible gravitational radiation in it. So little TAB 0 is equal 0. And then finally, we make various assumptions about the sizes of various small-scale quantities. And these assumptions correspond to small velocity or Newtonian assumptions at small scales. And we work in a transverse traceless gauge. And then the effective linearized Einstein equation reduces to something you would normally expect on the left-hand side. And then the right-hand side, I've just defined everything to be this theta AB, this first-order stress-energy perturbation. And then that takes this nice, simple form. So the 0, 0 component is the baryon, I mean, we have this baryon number density contribution, the perturbation at first order. We have the first-order perturbation to the momentum. And then we have new terms that correspond to precisely what one would expect from kinetic motions and Newtonian binding energy and stresses when you average it. So this PII, that is this long wavelength stress perturbation, just the average of rho VI VJ. And the C here, that is the Newtonian binding energy type term. So it's exactly what you would expect. There's nothing new and mysterious. And these results are completely consistent with what people like Daniel Bauman derive in this effective field theory of large scale structure. And in fact, if you assume that, and this is what they pointed out, that if you assume that your small scale structures are virialized, then these terms vanish as well. So there's really nothing going on in terms of back reaction. Okay, so to conclude, the only effect of small scale inhomogeneities on the leading order dynamics of the universe is via a p equals a third rho fluid, and that corresponds to gravitational radiation. And the weak energy condition on matter plays an essential role in this proof. More generally, no matter what happens at small scales, this TAB0 has positive energy properties, provided the real matter has positive energy. So there's some questions of, well, what does this have any sort of implications for stability? For example, I mean, if you could create, if your small scale, if you did something to small scales and it created some sort of large scale negative energy effect, you could imagine that could cause some sort of instability in your theory. And so there's a question, I think, it was very non-trivial to prove this. And in alternative theories, it's not clear that that would necessarily hold. And that could be a way to rule out some alternative theories of gravity, possibly. We haven't looked into that. Okay, at the linearized level, we split the deviation of the metric into short and long wavelength parts, and we got equations for the long wavelength parts, and we showed that they're exactly what you would expect in terms of Newtonian binding energy and stresses. So one thing I didn't mention in this talk is that this work also motivated us to do this analysis of Newtonian cosmology, and it really gave us intuition for like a counting scheme for mapping, say, if you had a Newtonian simulation that you've done, how you could map it into an approximate GR solution and determine corrections. And in fact, what we found is that, you know, Newtonian cosmologies actually provide an excellent approximation to Einstein's solutions for dust and a cosmological constant on all scales, even beyond the Hubble scale, which we were a little bit surprised about. But you can ask me about that later if you want. So thanks.
There exists exact homogeneous
solutions. Yeah.
Weinstein's good equations.
Mm-hmm.
They are not spherically symmetric.
Yeah.
So you have a problem with Copernicus. And if you average the homogeneous parts exactly, I think one can show that you can get acceleration. No perturbation theory at all.
So were you thinking of like LTB models or?
No, it's called the, for example, some solutions are called the Saffron.
Okay. Well, I'm not familiar precisely with those solutions, but I think the thing is that
what we're really addressing is small scale inhomogeneity. So whatever averaging scale has got to be much larger than these. So we assume that at some beyond some scale, the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. So we're not addressing that question of, say, what you would see in LTB models where you have some large scale inhomogeneity, like you're in the middle of a void or something like that. That's a totally different question. We're not looking at.
The point is that you have to be careful. You have built-in assumptions that give you the result you want.
Oh yeah, I mean we're not even asking. That's a separate question. Whether or not an LTB space-time can mimic a cosmological. Okay, well whatever large-scale and homogeneous model you might have.
Yeah. Hey, are you familiar with the work of David Wiltshire?
Yeah, and well, sort of.
The exact solution to the...
Yeah, this timescape thing. I'm not really...
So this doesn't apply to that... this is only for averaging.
Yeah, this is really for averaging small-scale inhomogeneities.
So an author as well of the paper that was a reply to the reply.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, I think... I think his work probably falls into more what John was talking about in terms of large-scale inhomogeneities.
It doesn't involve... averaging,
yeah,
but it's all also in the same frame.
Yeah.
Of authors, I think.
Yeah, yeah. There's some overlap, definitely. I should emphasize. There's really two kind of approaches. Is we have these small scale inhomogeneities that I was trying to address, and other people have these models where they imagine we're in a huge void or something other, some more complicated thing like that, where you have large scale inhomogeneities, and we're not saying anything about that. Yeah.
Supposing your small scale theory was not general absolute, but was some theory with less symmetry or less gain symmetry.
Yeah.
Could you use the methods to show that general absolute emerged as you could be
It emerged in what?
As a consequence of the average.
For
example, there are results in minus gain theory that show that if you break the Asian range to small scales, it averages out to nothing, and Yang-Mills theory is the theory of point spread.
Oh.
So I'm wondering if you might use this to show that there might be some modified theory with less symmetry at small scales and it's still so general to the emergence.
Yeah, that's conceivable, I guess. I mean, but it would take some thought to figure out how to adapt, you know, these assumptions to fit in with whatever that alternative theory is. But I mean, it's conceivable you could devise an averaging scheme like that to try to do the same thing. Yeah.
So what was the critique that Booker and Tal were?
Oh, yeah, there were a lot of, and so they had like a lot of different critiques. Some of them they would just say, our analysis is ultra local and that's it. That, you know, I don't know how to respond to something like that. They didn't like our ball bearing example because in two dimension, they just said, in two dimensions, the Gauss-Bonnet theorem holds. So, I mean, that was it. And I mean, so I think like you can read our response. We didn't give a lot of. We just addressed everything pretty quickly. And like I didn't really consider these. I guess they fell into a couple bins. I mean, they had some of what they said was that simply our proof was incorrect, their arguments didn't make any sense, and I think the biggest thing is they could disagree with our assumptions, and then they disagree with the conclusions, but they didn't make any sort of solid thing, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah.
If you're correct, then it means that one could derive all the cosmology at present from Newtonian gravity, including pressure.
Well, no, you can only do dust. The correspondence that we worked out only works for dust
but
and...
I think it's from the 30s and 40s.
Yeah, but I mean, the mapping to GR only seems to work with dust. I think the difference would be physically the, you know, pressure terms are going to gravitate in GR, but not in Newtonian gravity. So I think the correspondence breaks down when you go beyond dust.
Can you weaken the assumption of the metric being weak on big, weak wall scales? Or is it actually physically the case that if you had, say, a gas, dilute gas of black holes, you could get significant back action?
I think like the way to deal with that is I think you don't get significant back reaction, but the way to deal with that is you just have to replace any black hole you have with a star of the same mass, and then the star would be weak field, but outside of the star, it's the same, you know, by Birkhoff's theorem.
Sure.
So that's the way to handle it.
And can that be fitted neatly into what you?
Not so neatly. I don't think of it a neat way to do it.
In the effective field theory of topology stuff, how can they handle things like? Because I thought they didn't have to make assumptions in the method.
Oh, I think they. Well, they make Newtonian assumptions in that stuff. They assume everything's kind of Newtonian at small scales. So they don't have black holes in that case. But yeah, I don't know of a clean way to do that. So, yeah.
So any other question? Or so if not, let's thank Stephen again.